Have you ever wondered if your company is maximizing the return of your data investment? Are you collecting the right data required to make informed decisions? Is there more that can be learned from our data? Coyus Institute can answer these questions and help you discover the hidden value within your data sets by utilizing a well-rounded approach to data analysis. Stop leaving value behind and start increasing the return on your data investment. The next generation of data analysis has begun. We are pioneers in pattern discovery. We are Coyus Institute.
It's really great to have you on. I've been looking forward to this conversation for a while because I feel like you balance that fine line between different perceptual lenses when it comes to examining the UFO phenomenon. Obviously, you have your background as a religious scholar, plenty of connections and knowledge in those communities. You also have your connections into the intelligence and the government and communications with insiders and technologists and futurists. So I think it's fair to say you've kind of got a foot in the physical and the metaphysical, which I think is the best place to be to get a wider, more clearer picture of what we might be going through as it relates to non-human intelligence and the interactions that have occurred throughout history. So thank you so much for taking the time to be here.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
You're most welcome. And you also have a new book being published in November, I believe, titled Encounters, Experiences with Non-Human Intelligence. Now, the title's pretty self-explanatory, but could you give people a little bit of an idea of the inspiration behind this book and what people might expect from it?
Oh, sure. So obviously with American Cosmic, it was my first foray into writing about the topic of UFOs and UAPs. And it was a shocking thing for me because I was not somebody who had believed in UFOs previously, basically. And I'd been studying metaphysical and, you know, sometimes physical miraculous phenomena within the Catholic tradition. So, and in a professional way. So as a person who studies academically. So I'm not making claims of the truth or falseness of these things. I'm studying the cultural consequences and implications of belief and things like this. So I was pretty shocked in 2012 and 2013 to come into this community and recognize that there was, you know, what people were experiencing hundreds of years ago, even 1,000 years ago, even 2,000 years ago, you know, back a long time ago, these things were still being experienced today, and we have a different framework for understanding them today. So it was shocking to me. Anyway, so American Cosmic was a wake up for me, and it also took me to some locations that were really specific, like New Mexico. And I also had an experience that was interesting in that I traveled with Gary Nolan, who's well known in the UFO community and in the academic community. And I, at the time, this was prior to 2017, and the New York Times exposés by Leslie Kane and Ralph Blumenthal. And so I still was not a believer at all. And we traveled to an alleged UFO crash site in New Mexico. When I say alleged, these were one of the crash sites affiliated with Roswell, like the 1940s crash sites. It wasn't the Roswell crash site, though. So I traveled there with Gary, and who was named James in my book, and Tyler, who reminds me in a lot of ways of, you know, because he's the similar affiliations, if not exact affiliations, as Dave Grush. And so that what was said to Dave Grush was actually said to me, except I was even shown the parts, right? These are the parts, and these are where we retrieve them, kind of thing. At the time, I understood this in mythological terms as a modern Prometheus myth, literally. Like, Prometheus is the Greek god who gave humans technology back in the day, kind of like, you know, that was their religion, basically. And so I consider this to be kind of like a resuscitation of this, almost like an archetypal religion. But I mean, back in the day, it was like fire. And today it's these. And so it was a really weird experience for me. There's, you know, no lie. And so I've just been witnessing everything that's been going on. Encounters is like kind of a part two of that, where I'm now understanding what's going on. I get the landscape. I get kind of the, you know, disinfo aspect of it. I don't think you can actually do this work as an academic without addressing the disinfo, because it's been a part of it since the 1940s, even before that. And so, you know, that was really a difficult thing. I really had to deep dive into understanding how, you know, how that worked. And so Encounters is still looking at communities of people who've had these experiences, and these are high functioning people. Some of them, most of them keep their names. They're not, because I use pseudonyms in American Cosmic mostly. And, you know, we talked to Dr. Ia Whiteley, who's now working with Ryan Graves on doing kind of helping pilots and soon to be astronauts doing reporting of anomalies and things like that, because the culture of reporting has to change. It's really, it's, you know, it's getting better, but it's still not to the point where it should be. And so I talked to her about her work, and I talked to other people similar to her, you know, some affiliated with the military, some who are actually on the cutting edge of doing AI, because that's another aspect of this. And, you know, so it's a similar type of book. Some people are still in the book, like characters. Tyler makes a small appearance. And I talk more about the work with Jacques Bellet and you know, some of the things that people don't actually focus on within his work, which are esoteric currents within Valet and Hynek's works. So that's the book.
Well, this is, you know, this is a part of the conversation that is not necessarily on the immediate timeline when it comes to government disclosure. The experiences, the more ephemeral and harder to explain elements of the subjective experience people have with the phenomena. And I'm speaking myself as an experiencer. I wouldn't actually be in this field or have this platform and have done the interviews that I've done if I hadn't have had my own strange encounters, which changed the direction of my life. So I very much understand that it's a very subjective and much more controversial area of an already fringe area, which we're now trying to destigmatize. So I kind of see the timeline for experiences and sensible discourse in the wider kind of public arena to be a bit more of a long-term goal. But it's good to try and encourage that and bring these people out, because there are, as you well know, very well experienced people who've had sincere encounters.
Definitely. And, you know, Dr. Whiteley actually discusses this. I think she actually may have discussed it on a podcast, but she definitely has a conversation about this with me that I put in the book. And it's this idea that there are two data sets, right? So there's the data set of the nuts and bolts type of reporting. Oh, I saw this. These are the physical attributes of it. You know, this is what, these are things I observed. And then there's the actual experiences that these people have had with respect to this. And both of those data sets don't actually get reported, or they get reported, but usually to two different people. So she's a space psychologist. So she's, you know, it's her job to basically get all the data, all the reporting. And she's basically seen that, you know, she said, if there's two data sets, it's going to take 40 years to change this culture. And we don't have that time. We need to do it now. So she's right now working on trying to merge the ability of people to report so that they feel comfortable reporting the weird stuff, as well as the kind of really the observable stuff. And also, you mentioned something. You said the military disclosure. And I also want to point out that, in my opinion, there will be and there are ongoing different types of disclosures. So when we see this, what's happening right now, I've also discussed it as a military type of disclosure. But, you know, there are also, there is a Vatican disclosure, but they're not going to do press releases. You know, this is not how the disclosure of, you know, maybe other countries and other institutions, like religious institutions. It's, you know, people who are interested need to be aware of that the disclosure that they're expecting, it's going to take a different form for different institutions. And everybody's excited about this type of military disclosure, or what, you know, whatever they call it, you know, because it's a site of absolute contention right now. And I think that, you know, the things that are going on quietly, this is something that I learned with working with Tyler D for the years that I worked with him, is this idea that what's really happening is all the very important things that are happening, the changes that are being done, they're going to be behind the scenes. They're going to be invisible almost, you know, except for those who can kind of see how to identify. And I think that that's really important.
Well, like you said, it's multiple layers of disclosure. Different sectors of the population are going to respond to different types of, I suppose you could say, stimuli on this kind of subject. So there's an area for the political, national security, bureaucratic, military kind of speak. But then there's all of the spiritual communities, and how do they handle it? And how does that fit into your belief system? So that's definitely something I want to get into with you, especially regarding the Vatican. But in regards to the you know, the military disclosure, there's definitely been an acceleration in the last few days as it relates to the UFO conversation. I mean, most people by now are probably aware of the insider David Grush, who's provided Congress and the Inspector General with classified intelligence relating to, believe it or not, retrieval and reverse engineering programs. That wasn't something I expected right now. I'd had people saying that it was coming this year, and I was kind of just patiently holding my breath and waiting, but it's arrived a little earlier than I expected. So you've had David Grush come out, and he's got a validated background. He said that we have these intact, exotic, non-human vehicles being studied about 48 hours or just under 48 hours from when he made these statements. You then have apparently more military insiders and intelligence insiders who haven't given their names yet corroborating this and saying that we have 12 or more vehicles. So there's definitely suddenly been this acceleration. I'm wondering if you have any indication as to, you know, what might be at play here, why the pace is beginning to quicken with the claims of multiple non-human vehicles being studied. I mean, what's your take on all of this right now?
Okay, I think that I always urge caution. And I know that's a lot of people are very excited. Mm-hmm. And, you know, caution is probably not what they're interested in having with respect to this. But in the history of looking at this, the trajectory of this type of information getting into, you know, the public, it's helpful to look at the history of it. So what I do is I tend to look at the beginning of both the Russian and the American space program, and the types of things that people aren't going to be, you know, the non-obvious elements. And some of those elements are the place of media as a vehicle for, you know, as a vehicle for information dissemination. And people like, some of the things that happened to me when I first started to look, and by the way, this was my field before doing this. I looked at popular cultural representations of Catholic belief systems. So I was already prepared to look at how does the information get out to people? Well, for space exploration and rocket technology development, defense related to space, and even things that have to do with flying saucers. You know, if you look at the early 20th century and the 1930s and 40s, you do see an affiliation with Walt Disney. And at first, I thought that was really strange. I mean, I began to look through, I mean, I was looking for anything that I could find on the history, you know, kind of like an official history of the Air Force space program here. And you could go to their website and find a lot of stuff. You can even find digital documents and things like that. So I read all that I could read. This is in 2012, 2013. And also they have a lot of material culture data, which are photographs. And you see Wernher von Braun hanging out with Walt Disney and, you know, this and that. And I thought, Walt Disney, he's really, you know, he's really instrumental here. And why? So I would urge people to think through these connections, which I, you know, explore in American Cosmic, which your audience is most likely familiar with my work, I think. Maybe I'm wrong. But, you know, I spend a lot of time talking about how media informs our understanding of this idea of, you know, UFOs, flying saucers, and things like that.
Oh, Diana, you've got yourself on mute.
I'm sorry about that.
Oh, no, it's okay. It's okay.
Okay. So I know I have a cat.
That's all right. No worries.
Okay. So I think that these are important elements to understand in the current climate, especially because if people who are not interested in UFOs are now talking about them, I mean, that's a huge thing. How was that done? Well, it's done through social media, and it's done through the narrative getting into the popular press. And, you know, such that all of my friends who are non-UFO academics or just people I know, they don't care. You know, they're not thinking about it, but now they are. And so the question is, how did that happen? So I think that all of us in the community that look at UFOs and UAPs know that the general population and friends of ours, even maybe brothers and sisters, you know, they don't care about. This is something that they just don't think about. But now they're thinking about it. And that's what my friend with the analytics was doing. He was pointing out that, okay, these people have, you know, put in their face constantly the British royal family, no offense. But, you know, it's everywhere. You can't avoid it. And, you know, and things that we really don't want to think about, but we're forced to think about because it's everywhere. And now UFOs happen to achieve that status. Why? And these are the questions I ask. And is it because we have the, you know, David Grush coming out and with these claims? Not necessarily. It's because those claims have come out before. They came out in my book even. But they're coming out and being shared in major news. And if you look at the major news, the script is always the same. If you read it, you know, if you listen to it, the script is always the same. So that when I talk to the major news. And I talked to the major news before the Pentagon report. So a lot of people were asking me, you know, to have, you know, my opinion about this or that because I'm a professor and I study this. And so what I noticed is that they all asked the same questions and they all wanted to go in the same direction. And that to me is information. So as much as they were asking me, I was also identifying how they were being, you know, taught to talk to me. And they were, because there were, I won't name names, but there were fashion magazines, like UK fashion magazines, asking me about this. I'm thinking the interviewers from those magazines, they didn't care about UFOs. They didn't want to know about them, but they had to do a timeline. It was like part of their charge. They had to do a timeline and they had to show their readership that this was happening. And so I would take pictures of that as data, you know, as kind of, okay, this is how it's being presented and people don't actually care, but now they do because it's unavoidable. So I think that we have, I mean, honestly, I think we have to think about that. If we're thinking, you know, a lot of people concentrate so much on, is this craft? He says it's this or that, you know, and all that information was already out there. So I think it's interesting. So these are the things I think about.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, the information was already out there. There's some fantastic testimonies and clips. I posted one up recently on Twitter just as a kind of counter to the idea that David Grush is the first one. And it was Bob Exler back in the 1980s when he got Admiral Bobby Ray Inman to basically acknowledge on the record that the recovered vehicles might be one day released to the public knowledge, but he has no idea if it would ever happen. And, you know, there's been these types of testimonies from reliable people over the years, and now we're seeing David Grush. And I, like you, I try and tell my audience, because this is how I approach the subject, to just approach everything with a degree of skepticism and be cautious, especially when it comes to narratives being propagated by the military industrial complex and the IC and the government, because I think what happens sometimes is we fall into the trap of, well, they're telling me what I want to hear, so I'm just going to eat this up like a kid in a candy store. You know, they've got craft, they've got vehicles, they've been studying it. Finally, I feel vindicated. They're acknowledging it, and you dive head first. And I think that it's always good to maybe just try and look a couple steps ahead. Why exactly are they allowing this kind of information to come out? What kind of benefit must it have internally for the IC and the military industrial complex? Because they're not going to deliberately kneecap themselves by saying, yeah, we've been holding it secret this whole time and just let the pitchforks come and a revolution kicks off. I don't think that they want to see that kind of disruption. So I would have to imagine that the way in which this is being discussed is a very curated narrative. And although I don't know whether or not it's an ultimately benevolent or benign or malevolent narrative, I try and stay cautious from being kind of sucked up into the frenzy of it. It is exciting. I have been sending my family all the clips of David Grush, and it's certainly, you know, creating a bit of a frenzy. I mean, my family WhatsApp's popping off going, oh my God, is this really real? I was like, yeah, this is actually happening. Not quite sure what's going on, but it is happening. So you're right. No, you're right to view it through the lens that you view it. And I think that's the only way you can, because there is so much evidence for intelligence interference on this issue, you know, going back several decades, and the US government and the kind of collaboration with the media is a historically known fact. And we know that there's been a lot of falsified narratives over the many decades of this kind of collusion between media and government. So to think that that wouldn't be happening with what is really one of the most disruptive, most sensitive, most classified subjects suddenly being discussed in the public domain, you have to imagine they've got the guardrails up and they're doing this in some way to maybe save face or prepare. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
From my perspective, it definitely seems as if it's... I know that a lot of people want to say this, and believe me, I kind of do too, you know, that this is a coordinated disinfo, you know, kind of thing. But from my perspective and knowing people that I know, it seems like it just got out of control. You know, there was a desire to get the information out, but that it steamrolled and snowballed.
Right.
And a lot of people were not prepared for that from the perspective of, I think,
kind of the toothpaste is out of the tube situation.
Yeah. And I think that's been the case actually since, but that's okay. I mean, you know, this isn't to say that it's not true.
Right.
It just means that it's a certain perspective of it. And, you know, and so what I ask in encounters is, what's the stuff that's kind of in not being asked? What's the stuff that when you go on, you know, when you go on a podcast with one of these major people who, I'm not saying you're not major, but you're asking some questions that most people aren't asking actually. And they're not asking those questions on purpose. And so I think that, you know, I think that that's I ask those questions, and now a lot of people I know are just want to keep a low profile about it because we don't know what's going to happen next. At least I don't. I do know that it's going to keep going, but I don't know how it's going to keep going.
Yeah, I think that I feel that way about the whole world in general right now. I mean, you know, UFOs is kind of a symptomatic response almost. There's so many other things happening around the same time period as this, which again makes me think that it could be actually a component of this this green lighting of a disclosure. Because you know, I don't know how you feel, but I kind of feel like we're staring over a precipice right now. On one side is the society we have, the values, the beliefs, the understandings we have, and on the other side, the side we seem to be kind of stepping closer towards, represents some form of transformation process, the amalgamation of artificial intelligence and quantum computation, more advanced models of consciousness, its novel effects, our understanding of parallel worlds and dimensions, the increased awareness of non-human intelligences. It just feels like this is the beginning of almost a new chapter. And when you know, when you analyze the intuitive and the prophetic nature of religious cultures over time with their proclamations of an end time or an epoch or a judgment day, And you correlate these intuitive kind of prophecies with the more analytical projection from technologists and futurists that we're moving towards a singularity, a biosynthetic symbiosis, the birth of an artificial god. It almost feels as if everyone is feeling the same thing, but we're simply translating it through our particular lens of perception. So some see the end time, some see the awakening of human consciousness, some see the birth of an artificial god through AI, but all of these claims have, I suppose, embedded within them, despite their differences, an underlying similarity, which is this feeling that we're transforming, that we've reached a definitive moment in our evolutionary story. So what is your intuition and what does your intellect tell you personally? Where does it feel like we're going to you?
Okay, that's a really great question and difficult to answer.
Very difficult to answer.
But I'll you know, and I don't think it can be answered, but I think that we can have a discussion about it.
Exactly.
And yeah, so okay. After American Cosmic was published. So recall that in that book, that person, Tyler, he was always asked by the places where he worked to forecast. So one of his jobs was that once a year, he would be put into that room called the Room of the Impossible, where you can think anything. And he would be told, write down everything that you think is going to happen in a 5-year, you know, in 5 years, like everything you can think of. And so he was doing that because, and he may not have been the only person to do that. And so he had an ability. What made him so good at his job, and apparently still good at his job, is that he can know things almost like before they happen, right? Because you need that skill for space launching and things like that, rocket launching. So they were utilizing him in that way. And after it was published, I was blessed in a sense to meet more people that were like that, even more like that. And these people were had been for 20 years the creators of AI, and had a belief system that was similar to his, what I would call like a, if anybody's interested to follow up on that, the belief system is like the cosmist belief system.
Oh, this is a Russian thing, right?
It is, yeah. It's this idea that human evolution is coming to this point. Ray Kurzweil picked up on it when he wrote the book The Singularity, but he had been around for a while.
Yeah.
And it's this idea. So there is an evolutionary idea that, you know, humans didn't stop evolving, you know, we're still evolving, and now we're evolving with technology, and that we're at that point now where it is exponential. And we do see that. We do see that. And, you know, we can say that it's a scary time. I tend to see it as a very exciting time.
Yeah.
I think it's incredible. It's an incredible time to witness, because I was actually talking about this with my mother and she was saying, you know, she just didn't have this idea, even though she's not religious and she's very scientific, and she's, you know, she has a master's degree in nursing, and, you know, so, and she said, you know, I suggested that, you know, humans were evolving at this point with technology, and she stopped me and she said, humans are evolving. And I said, well, haven't we been evolving? Or, you know, don't we do that? And what about natural selection and epigenetic changes? And so it didn't occur to her. But then she thought about it that way, and she thought, oh, okay. And she was on board with thinking about this. A friend of mine just gave a talk on AI and its potential and the doomer idea of AI. And she was bringing this idea to a lot of people who are afraid of AI. And she said, and so she gave them a graph, and she said, look at the increase in wealth and the increase in, you know, water, fresh water to people, and this and that. And she explained that linkage was human flourishing had a direct link with technology, right? Technological development. And so they kind of were on board, but they still didn't like it. They didn't like AI, didn't like technology. And then she said, okay, here's another way to look at it. Here's some the graph of money, and let's look at how much money. And do you see that those people who have been using AI now for 30 years or more have been the economic industry, the bankers? They've been using AI. So I think it's time, you know, what's wrong with using AI to decentralize money, to decentralize, to bring it to people? And, you know, I tend to agree with her with respect to that. If AI is here, well, I think we need to, it's like the UFO disclosure. It's not going back into the bottle, right? It's out. So AI is out. And I think we can actually utilize it. And in fact, there's not a choice. So I think that, I also think it has a lot of, implications for this, you know, idea of non-human intelligence.
Yeah.
Although I will leave my friends, I do talk about it in encounters, but I leave that discussion to my friends who are expert at AI, because I'm not.
Well, but it's good to ponder about it, especially because, like you said, it's so prevalent. It's a real marker of our position right now in human evolution. We are still evolving. And I think it was Terence McKenna that once said that the story of the human being is the story of the monkey becoming the flying saucer. And it does feel that way. And I would say that when it comes to technology, you know, since the first time we picked up flint and struck flint to make flame and sharpened a stick to make a spear, we've been developing and propagating technology as a tool through which we exert our influence over our environment. We've been doing that since the dawn of humanity. So, you know, this is our baby that we've been gestating, and we're now giving birth to this artificial medium. So I have to think to myself that as much as it sounds and seems scary and could, you know, go down dystopian narratives, and, you know, it's all of our references for it are things like Matrix and Terminator and Blade Runner and, you know, these scary concepts. But, you know, I try to say to people, at least from my own perspective, if I think about my own life and, you know, the moments in my life where it's been very chaotic or dark and it's hard to really see, you know, oh, I'm never going to feel good again, or, you know, you're in a rut. And then later down the line, you look back and you go, oh, okay, I kind of see why that needed to happen. I see how that helped me progress. It helped me get wiser, get stronger. And I like to think that if you look at the collective human group as a single entity, we're just going through the developmental stresses and strains of evolving. And yes, it does mean that there'll be chaos and uncertainty and very disruptive catalysts that come across and kind of like sweep the rug from under us as a society. But are these necessarily negative elements, or are these necessary kind of prerequisites? You know, is there, for example, an evolutionary prerequisite for us to in some way meld spirit and science together, connect intuition and logic, physics and metaphysics, in order for us to progress our perception of reality? Do we need hemisphere synchronization between what many consider to be opposing worldviews, spirit, science, when in reality, perhaps the clearest picture can be divined when these perspectives are in some way married together? What do you think?
Yes, I don't see a duality. And this has been a theme in all of my work, even with the book on purgatory. This idea of separating spirit and matter, you know, the separation of spirit and matter, which, you know, is really just a framework of perception. And I think that, especially when there's talk of this, the UFO, you know, and the back engineering of the, you know, what this is, and there's no talk of the weird experiences that a lot of the people who allegedly say they work on the craft or the parts and things like that, you know, their experiences doing that and the kinds of research that are being done with respect to interfacing with it, right? As a, I would call it like, some people call it, I can't remember the term that's used by some of the scientists, but a multidimensional object. Yes, so I'm in agreement with you. And I think you said that very well, actually. I don't think I can say it better.
Well, thank you. One of the physicists that I was lucky enough to meet and then and get on the record was Oak Shannon, former special projects manager for Los Alamos, and he said the same thing that we could be looking at a multi-dimensional object coming into a lower dimensional plane, which is our existence, and perhaps not we're not really getting the full picture from these things, which begs the question as to how you can recover them, which means it could just be a spectrum. I suppose there could literally just be space aliens in spaceships crashing or being shot down or landing. But I do think there's another component to this. To me, the UFO subject is an extremely philosophical and metaphysical conversation. There isn't a clear-cut distinction between the physical and the metaphysical within this space. Because these objects, these UFOs, they behave in ways that seem ethereal. And I think, if you look back on someone like Arthur C. Clarke, his famous statement that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. So, I guess, is there space for this to be just sufficiently advanced technology, or is there also room for magic? Is there room for a strange melding between, as we just said, science and spirit, between our realm and the realms beyond it? Or is it simply space aliens in advanced spaceships, and we could just be looking at something so incredibly sophisticated that it comes off as spiritual or ephemeral in some way? Or could it really be borrowing from the angelic and demonic archetypes of religious teachings? Where do you sit? I know that Jacques Vallée, for example, was having quite a battle of ideology with himself over what this might represent. Kind of looked at the Jungian framework of a collective overmind and the ways in which non-local consciousness as a collective group might be creating these things like manifestations. There are so many different avenues to explore with the potential origin of this stuff. Where would you place your cards for the majority of UFO experiences? Do you think it's space aliens or something far, far stranger?
Okay, so when you say space aliens, you're talking about the
Alpha Centauri took a few thousand light years to get here, kind of thing.
Yeah, so I mean, even that hypothesis, the ET hypothesis, if you think about it, it could also be weird as well.
Oh
You know, it
yeah,
could be that they're coming
maybe
through.
I'm just desensitized to it by now, Diana. But
No,
you're
I think
absolutely right.
both of us are. I think both of us are. First, we have to understand that, like, historically, people don't understand this. I think contemporary people don't understand that people have always thought about this. So even people back in the day, like Aquinas, say the 12th, scholastic, doctor of the church, person from Catholic history was talking about other worlds and quote unquote people on other worlds. Emanuel Swedenborg in the 1700s was speaking about it, even wrote a book about it, said that he had direct communication with people on other worlds as well. And, he didn't call them extraterrestrials. He just said that they were people, spirits, angels, things like this. He had a huge taxonomy of these beings. Tyler had a taxonomy of these beings as well, which, by the way, changed as I knew him. It developed. Okay, so I also discuss this in Encounters when I talk about this idea of hyper objects. So, in a sense, we're at a time when not only are we going into space, like physically, and seeing things that we've never seen before, and even seeing objects that are so incredibly large that we can't actually see them. We can only see them through a telescope, right? We can only see them through our technology. So there's a mediation between us and these objects. And that's the same thing that's happening digitally. So not only are we going out into space, but we're going in to these screens, into digital environments where we're also, especially quantum environments, where we're dealing with things that we can't possibly understand without use of technology. And so technology, in a sense, has to be our second set of eyes in order to, it has to become us in a way to enter these environments. And so Dr. Whiteley, by the way, is very aware of the kinds of consciousness that accompanies, say, people, astronauts in space, but even pilots and pilots that encounter anomalies and things like that. And there is a shift. And not only that, but anthropologists have been looking at these hyper objects that people, you know, dimensional objects like platonic solids and things like that, that we can only really conceive of through either the language of mathematics or, you know, or modeling through computers and getting to these ideas. So this is what I'm talking about in terms of this unprecedented time period for us, is that we now have the ability to, through our technology, you know, see with a different set of eyes. And it's technology that is our glasses, really, you know, our glasses. And this does change our consciousness. It does change the way in which we exist.
Well said. Do you think that much like the UFO flap that occurred once we detonated the atomic bomb, that a similar type of situation, perhaps even actually greater levels of interest from these non-human actors, is occurring as we get closer to what some believe to be the singularity? Could this be a bigger moment in evolution that they're trying to observe and perhaps interact with?
Okay, so you're referencing external agents, right? So you're referencing non-human external agents and the control mechanism puppet masters of Jacques Vallée's idea, right? I think that's what I'm just trying to get a clarification.
To be honest, more just from whatever perspective you currently have with what this stuff is. I mean, you know, we saw at least what seemed to be a pretty significant uptick in strange things in the sky and things coming over military bases when we were starting to blow up atomic bombs. And it feels like an increase in the volume of either sightings or certainly interest from the US government's happening now as we approach what we were saying before, this weird precipice of a next kind of chapter in human history, which certainly seems to be underpinned by AI rising into prominence. So I just wonder if you feel like this is almost like the second atomic bomb, another signature propagating out that says, hey, this civilization's just hit another level, and maybe they're ready for it, maybe they're not ready for it.
Yeah, so, okay, I would have to say that perhaps the reason that we do see an uptick in this is, first, the culture of reporting has changed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And secondly, we have more things in the sky looking at. You know, we have more sensing instruments, right? We not only have people with phones, but we also have drones and, you know, or more drones and satellites and things like that. So we're looking more, and I think we're seeing more. So it could be almost like a mass, you know, we're going through a mass kind of like a waking up, like, mm-hmm. or at least not waking up, but leaving behind perceptions that are old perceptions. And so I would look at it, I would tend to see it that way. And in terms of ascribing external agency to it, I've been looking at this idea of external agents in terms of people like the people who founded our space program, not just ours, but the Russian space program, as well as people like Tyler or people who are engaged in creating AI and things like this. They often speak of getting information, like the download experience, let's put it that way, that you can find in the philosophies of Plato, speaking about Socrates and stuff, and also a lot of the math mystics of the ancient Greek time period. They spoke in the same way of this kind of daimon or this muse.
The muse, you know, yeah.
Yeah, giving them information, and it wasn't their information. These were external agents. And what I found was that a lot of people who do brain research, cognitive research, and neuroscience into creativity, extreme creativity, find that your frontal, I guess it's called the executive functioning part of your brain, basically shuts down during this time period. And it appears to the person themselves that this information is being placed into them by some external agent, and they can call it whatever they want. They can call it the goddess Lakshmi and Ramanujan's, you know, external agent, or ET or, okay, so that the name doesn't really matter. What matters is this process. So are we then, so to me, it seems like you're suggesting, as well as Jacques' control hypothesis, that there is an external agent doing this to us, as kind of molding us into this idea that, you know, we're evolving, and are we ready to make it to this kind of next stage? And so I question the autonomy of the external agent. Is there really one outside of us, or is it just us, you know, and we just don't understand what we actually do, you know, the kinds of things that we actually are capable of doing as a species. So just to say that, that's just one, you know, suggestion. Another one is that we shouldn't tend, in my opinion, this is just my opinion, we shouldn't think of ourselves as once, you know, we have many various cultures within our species. And some of them have, like, the texts that influence us, you and me, in this Western world, they don't influence those other cultures, say indigenous cultures, like indigenous Australians. They already feel like they went through an apocalypse, right? They did. You know, they were, their culture was almost entirely wiped out. But it, you know, and their culture is very old and most likely would continue. Okay. So they're going to have, they're not going to look to the same types of books or precedents. You know, you mentioned the Matrix and, you know, these kinds of things, almost like a template for us now. And I do see that. And I think it's important for us, because I do think that it is applicable. And it goes back to, you know, it's just a restructuring of Plato's cave, the allegory of the cave. But when you look at the allegory of the cave, there are things even that we don't even pay attention to, like the presence of, you know, you see in the allegory of the cave, the people who are tied up and they're looking at the shadows on the cave and they think that's reality. And this person leaves and sees that, wow, there's something outside the cave, and comes and tells his or her friends. And they are like, you're crazy. You're a conspiracy theorist, paraphrasing. But nobody actually talks about who are these people that are tying us up, right? Who are the people that are actually tying up and creating the show, right? So we never really talk about that. And I think that's probably where we are right now in our society, at least, not in these other societies that are, you know, never had that they were never in the Matrix, right?
Right, right.
You know what I'm saying? So yeah, look at us as very, you know, we're not just one type of species. We have various ways of being, and we tend to think of ourselves as this monolithic. When I say we, I'm talking about, you know,
Western culture.
Yeah. UK,
yeah,
North America, yeah. You know, but it's not like that for a good portion of humans.
It's a great point to make, Diana. And I think, you know, there's one way of looking at that in terms of the, you know, our own Plato's cave, is that, yes, we are very sophisticated. We have our atom smashers and our fusion reactors, but there's a group of people in the Amazon basin meeting God every Sunday by drinking a shamanistic brew and being told information about the coming future of humanity and the dawning of a new age of consciousness. And so we're in a completely separate universe to other people who are exploring different avenues of thought, and even between kind of like Eastern and Western medicine and these
pieces
of opinion, you know, and the age of enlightenment and the kind of reductionist type of ideas that we have in the West are not necessarily shared or even accurate, as much as they've propelled us technologically and in a certain type of sophistication. We've lost that conscious sophistication and connection.
Yeah, I think so. I think that, I mean, there's probably a connection between the technological development and the losing of that type, because you almost, in a sense, there. If you look at, you know, I was looking at my friend's graph, and I was thinking, you know, like people like Max Weber, you know, mentioned that capitalism was created through this idea of the Protestant work ethic, right? And you know, and that's not and he said it's definitely not Catholic in the sense that, you know, he said, and this is very offensive, but, you know, the people who were doing this work these are the quote-unquote fathers of the field of religious studies and anthropology. They were doing this work, and they were, you know, they were of their time period. So they had, you know, racist and sexist, you know, interpretations. And they said, you know, Max Weber was saying, Catholics are way too interested in having fun and, you know, and being lazy. And the Protestants are kind of, you know, they'll put off be having a good time in order to create wealth. And so he saw this as kind of the beginning of capitalism, the Protestant ethic. So, yeah, it's called the book is called Disenchantment and the Protestant Ethic, if anybody's interested in following up on that.
So you've had a lot of interactions, obviously, with the Vatican Church because of your discipline and interactions with its leadership. How familiar with the UFO issue would you say the Vatican Church and perhaps other powerful faith groups are? And is there any cross-pollination between these religious institutions and, for example, Western intelligence communities?
Definitely. And they're very aware. They follow it, absolutely, and have their own idea of it. And it's not like this is exactly what we were talking about a minute ago. You know, there's a Vatican type of disclosure, and it's not hard to find. It's easy, but it's not what people in the UFO community expect or want. It's not secular. And when I say secular, you know, we look at these craft as, you know, with the lens of a secular, we have a secular lens for looking at it. What if they're not that way? What if it's not that way? So let's take an example. In this country, we have what's called the separation of church and state, right? It's a secular, supposedly a secular, it's not, but say, you know, for the record, let's just say, okay, let's say that it is. It's, you know, we tend to keep religion out of it, or questions of spirituality out of it, right? Even the idea of religion is actually a secular idea. It was created in a secular environment. So that's a binary that's not even, I mean, we only utilize it in our countries. So if you go to, say, North American Indigenous communities, First Nation communities, or Australian Indigenous communities, religion is, they don't even use the term, but they're definitely not secular. Okay? They do have ideas of other intelligences and beings and star nations and things like that. So I would suggest that the Vatican is similar. They were before any kind of secular Western, you know, they're not going to be looking at it in the way in which we're interpreting disclosure or craft. Oh, they definitely have an idea. Absolutely. They would, of course. Their archives are filled with these reports.
Well, this is it. This is an avenue I kind of want to walk down with you for a moment. And if I said that I believe that the Roman Catholic Church or the Vatican has essentially played the role of an intelligence community network throughout history, obfuscating disruptive truths, maybe sequestering and classifying historical intelligence that was considered too world-changing for the global population, would you argue against that, or would you say that that is an element of its existence?
Yes, I think that it's not hard to see that. I mean, right. We've now, I am not a spokesperson for the Catholic Church, okay? I am a practicing Catholic, and I understand the problems with Catholicism, okay? I'm not like a blind person who just, you know, accepts a lot of the things that are horrific within that history. But, you know, I think that a lot of people have to understand that to consciously keep this idea of being a practicing Catholic, I do that because I know people who are like my friend Sister Rose, or like, you know, a lot of the sisters and monks and people who are actually out there feeding people, helping people. They don't care about UFOs. They're just doing what they know needs to be done to help people. I'm not a Catholic. I don't remain a Catholic because of what I see in the Catholic hierarchy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I think that should be said.
The institution of power is different to the boots on the ground behavior.
Yeah, and even the mystical elements within the church. I think that, you know, this also can keep a person in the church, you know, the mystical elements, the transmission of this too. So what I see, I absolutely agree with you that there is this element within the church. And that's what I've been saying in terms of looking at especially the formation of the church. And it's, you know, I spend a lot of time when I teach this to my students, I spend a lot of time on the first 300 years of early Christianity, because I think that was the most amazing and revolutionary time period for that. Because you can, in that small time period, you see a Jewish man, probably in a tradition that includes what's called the Merkabah tradition, which is a Jewish, it's a Jewish mystical tradition that has to do with chariots. And he's transmitting this to, in code, by the way, because he's very specifically not speaking to, he's speaking to those who can hear. And he says that. He says, I'm speaking in parables. And he's, you know, and a lot of times his apostles and disciples are like, what are you talking about? And he's basically saying, all right, listen, you know, I'm doing this for you. I'm sharing this to you. And so this takes off like wildfire. Why? Because he's basically, I mean, honestly, it's just like a decentralization of power, you know, that Jewish people in the first century are under a terrible situation with Rome. Rome dominates. Rome is an oppressive military regime that dominates. They crucify people and put them on their roadways so that when you go to Rome, you'll see this and you'll think, okay, I'm not going to mess with Rome. Okay. So here comes this person who's basically teaching his group of people who are Jewish how to survive in Rome. And he's giving them hope. And he's also opening a completely beautiful world to them of, you know, look, you know, consider the lilies of the field. You know, they don't work. And, you know, but look at them. Look at how beautiful. And there is a God. There is a force of good. This is just beautiful, not only to the Jewish people, but to Roman people, too, who don't like being subjected to the laws of Rome. And we're talking about actually women. So a lot of the people who convert to early Christianity are Roman women, and they do get killed for it too in the Roman games. So like Perpetua and Felicitas and, you know, these women that we've forgotten. And why have we forgotten them? Well, sadly, because of the Roman Catholic Church, you know, so what happened was that a lot of that history was then taken and so a lot of the elements were they were completely reinterpreted. Or even burned, you know. So what I do is I look at the history of the church, and I also look at the history of ufology, you know, and also the, you know, what's happening. And I think that in the current climate with especially social media and internet and things like that, honestly, as a researcher, I can't find certain things that I could easily find even a year ago. So it's this, this won't be like an oppressive kind of, you know, let's take away this information and ban these videos and things like that. It's going to be a flooding of social media. It'll be a flooding of the internet with things that will drown out a lot of the revolutionary ideas that go along with I think the new UFO experience, which is very similar to this Merkabah experience, if not the same thing that's happening. I don't know if it's the same thing, but it could very well be. And if I may say, there's also an oral tradition that's similar. So this oral tradition that then gets passed along is also within the intelligence communities. So you have a lot of the people who are saying, you know, let's get the redacted data, let's get this data. Well, of course, the intelligence communities happen to be intelligence, you know, and they know exactly, oh, we're not going to do that anymore. You know, it's going to be something that's passed person to person.
Yeah, it's a bit like a secret society in that regard, and it's just quietly handed down from the worthy to the worthy. And we're seeing, like you say, a little bit of this starting to leak out into the public area, or is leak even a fair way to put it? It's being curated out perhaps into the public, and still trying to understand the real reason behind that. One of my friends sent me a message when I said that I was coming on with you, and I'm not sure if this is the right place to put it, but I'm just getting the intuition that it might be in terms of secret societies and the phenomenon and ancient history. He wanted me to ask you what kind of connection you know of between the phenomenon and the Knights of Malta.
Okay, so I would say that, for one thing, I'm not, that's a group that I'm not a part of. I can't be a
Okay.
part of that group, okay? So, but all right, the Knights of Malta, and there are societies within the Catholic Church that are, during, I don't know how familiar your audience is with the Catholic Church, but during Vatican II, a lot of things happened. And one of the things that happened was some of these very intensive, devout groups were kind of, I wouldn't say excommunicated, but almost excommunicated. Some of them actually were. And then brought back after John Paul II kind of brought them back into the church. The Latin Mass was actually forbidden for a while. And there was so much outcry about that because that transmission, some people felt was in that mass, that transmission. And so these societies believe that they also carry this lineage, this lineage of transmission. Like a I you know, in my field, we don't just study one religion, we study many religions. And I also see this in Buddhist esoteric communities. Like you do see it in different Tibetan Buddhist communities of a lineage of transmission. And in we tend not to think about that in Protestant religion, religions, Protestant denomination of Christianity. But you absolutely see this within Catholicism. You see a transmission. And so these like Knights of Malta. So let's put it another way. Let's put it a way that I hope that now we've cleared some grounds with in terms of understanding that let's move our perspective from the binary of secular religion and religious. And then let's look at this idea of the phenomena as, say it is something that has to do with, if we look at, say, somebody like Francis of Assisi, who is a saint within the Catholic Church, probably the most popular saint. And he has a very, he had an extraordinary connection with the earth and the environment and non-human intelligences like animals, right? So if you can't pass a garden without often without seeing a statue of him and he's holding, he's got birds, and things like that. So there's something here. And he also had some very interesting interactions with what are described in the primary sources as a flying torch, a torch that came down and interacted with him. Well, some would say that he was part of this transmission and this Merkaba mysticism, Merkaba mysticism. Now, I've talked to people who are experts at this mysticism, the Jewish Merkaba mysticism, and they will absolutely hate what I'm saying right now. And but a lot of them, two of them in particular, I've talked with at length, agree that this is the case. But they'll say they will never say that publicly, and they will probably hate that I'm saying it as well. And I'm not saying it as an expert in, Merkaba mysticism, but it looks similar to me. If you're looking at the kinds of things that happen, the patterns, a flying torch from the sky coming down, actually hurting people in some cases, dealing harshly with them, in the sense, but also changing them in a transformative way that then gets interpreted as transformational in a way in which the Catholics understand Francis has been transformed. And then Francis obviously is so charismatic that we just still talk about him today.
Well, I think about these interpretations because, like you said, it certainly echoed through our theological framework, encounters with the unknown in various ways, in various forms, from, you know, the burning bush to the wheels of Ezekiel to everything in between. There has been these encounters, which now, through our particular type of lens, is translated as flying saucers or alien greys. But, you know, could this be the same thing, and it's interacting subtly and kind of nudging us in certain directions? I think about my own experiences. To briefly give you one example of my experiences, all of them have been from me actually getting into a conscious, like, kind of meditative state in my backyard and projecting the intention. So a lot of people know about that through what's called CE5. I don't follow any sort of particular regimen with it. I just through a very strange synchronistic coincidental journey arrived at the realization personally that yes, this works, I believe it works, and I went out with full intention that it works. And there is a backstory to that, but just for time's sake, I'll just say at this point I was very secure in my belief that this was possible, and I was going out into my backyard, getting into a very basic meditative state, and just projecting this intention that I'd like to see something. What I ended up having occur in 2019 in August was I had three of these orange orbs of light zip across the sky at high speed, stop on a dime above my property high up in the sky. They began to descend down towards my house, kind of weaving like this around each other as they came down, and they froze about 5 feet above the roof of my house, these kind of basketball-sized, slightly transparent orange orbs of light. And, I think about an experience like that, and you take it thousands of years ago, and that would have been, you know, the angels of God coming down to greet me from the heavens, and that's how I would have interpreted that experience at that time. So it makes me wonder if we really are dealing with just the same phenomena with lots of different faces. Do you think that's the case?
In certain instances, yes, I do think that's the case. And that is a controversial thing to say, actually, in my field, okay?
Yeah.
And another person who does think this as well, but doesn't like to reduce it, is Jeffrey Kripal at Rice uh-huh. University.
He's great.
So he's basically, and I agree, we actually had the same ideas at the same time and were shocked. Mm. You know, this was in 2011, 2012. That, you know, because he also comes from the Catholic tradition. Although that's not what he studied at graduate school, but that's his tradition. And so we both looked at a lot of these elements within the Catholic history. And it appears, you know, I do actually, I've written a lot about this comparison. And it's all actually free, and it's on my academia.edu website. All you need is a password to get to it. You just use, make a password, and it's called UFO in Purgatory. It's like a comparison. So a lot of those things were, like those orbs, were interpreted as souls from purgatory.
Right.
And that's actually how I started to study UFOs, is because there were so many reports of these orbs that would go through people's, you know, nun cell, for example, or things like that. And I didn't know what they were. I didn't think they were UFOs or anything like that. I actually just didn't know. And so I had a whole catalog of those things. And that's how I started to study modern day reports of UFOs. So I definitely think that. I think that there are a lot of things, though. There are a variety of these types of things. But I do think that you can make the case that, yeah, what we saw, you know, what we just have a different interpretive framework. I know a police officer, actually, a police chief, who, or... what would you call them? Sergeant, a captain, somebody who's high up in the police in the California, who as a very, you know, I've known this person my whole life, had this experience of an orange orb that when he was around 11 years old, followed him and chased him while he was on his bicycle. And now he's seen, and then he had similar experiences of people who have, you know, see visitors in their room at night and things like that. And this person would never talk about this experience and never talk about these things. But because I've known this person my whole life, I witnessed that the kinds, you know, first I witnessed who he was and his character. And I also witnessed which was, you know, an incredibly good person here and a stand-up person, and his reticence to talk about it. Now he's watched almost all of Gary Nolan's interviews, and he's able to now think about what happened to him in a way, you know, that in a way that makes him feel better about it, even though to him, it was a traumatic experience to him, right? He wasn't thinking of CE5 at all.
No, no.
You know, CE5 was not around when he was 11 years old. He was terrified. And so, you know, what's happening in a sense is helping a lot of people, that person included, a lot of people who are good people and who knew that if they said anything about their experiences, that their jobs were in jeopardy. You know, these are the people who are being helped. And I told Gary that too. I said, Gary, you know, you're getting a lot of flack. You're getting a lot, you know, but what you're doing is helping many people, many good people.
Yeah, because it just gives people the space to feel like they're, again, not alone. And there's, you know, a level of credibility assigned to people who have a very high-level career and come out and say, hey, look, I've had my own experiences with this. It is real. And, you know, I almost think sometimes with this this phenomena and these experiences, it could be a little bit like someone giving you a psychedelic and you don't really know what it is, and you take it and go, oh, well, what can I expect? And, well, probably a bit of a traumatic experience because you're not ready for that type of thing.
Right.
Versus going into it with reverence and understanding and like, okay, I'm going to learn something from this experience. And I think maybe if you're caught unawares with something so novel, so kind of reality bending, it could be a very traumatic experience to integrate into your life. I do think that there is some level of almost neural genesis that seems to occur when you have an experience with the phenomena, because your brain, I guess, has to either accept or reject what it's just experienced. So if you reject it, it will probably crystallize as a form of trauma for you. And if you accept it, it could potentially open your mind up to a wider sense of reality. And, you know, absent a definitive explanation of what's really going on with this phenomena, I feel like what you can say at face value, just by it existing, is that it challenges all our preconceptions of the laws of physics and what's in reality, how consciousness behaves. All of these things seem to be wrapped up neatly with a tied bow with the UFO. It's kind of hovering above us as this example of all the impossible things we thought were impossible being made possible. So it has, I guess, inherent within it, with exposure, some form of neural genetic effect in the brain. And, you know, I guess can either make or break someone's psychology.
Yes, I think so. And I also think that, I noticed that this was a conversation I had with Tyler when we worked together. And we noticed that there were people who really, really wanted to study the artifacts, or, you know, the alleged artifacts, or, you know, or have, you know, interface with the phenomenon, things like that. But they didn't. And we noticed some people who didn't really care or want interface or even come, you know, into the programs to study some of these things. And they did. And so we started to notice what they, you know, the difference. And it appeared to be that a character difference, a difference in character. And so I pursued this line of inquiry with one of the people in the new book. And we discussed that, you know, that in traditional societies, like I do have some people that I engaged with through someone who was like an interpreter, people in Indigenous Australians of the Martu Indigenous community. And they have a lore, and they definitely have a lore of these beings. But only certain people can actually be initiated into that lore. And I thought that was similar to what we were seeing, Tyler and I were seeing. Like, there were only certain people who could actually do this. And it had to do with a certain type of honesty, not even a goodness, really, but a type of honesty. And so a friend of mine was suggesting to me, who's this person who's very intelligent and works with AI, suggested that it works like it works cryptographically, that it's almost as if there are, you know, there's a key, And the key happens to be something that we never, that traditional religious community in the West would recognize, is that it's character. If character is a certain way, it works as a key to walk into
right.
these kinds of experiences.
I like
but it's
that.
Definitely not for, yeah, I mean, it would be a cool thing, right? Then just be a better person. And but well, I don't know if it's the case, but I'm just saying that this is the preliminary looking at this.
It certainly, at least from my own experiences, feels like intention is so important, at least in terms of like actually trying to engage with this phenomena and elicit a response from it. Because as you said, it's not necessarily even about being a good person. I mean, I've got plenty of my own issues. And as a human, I'm 28 years old. I'm still figuring out how to be an adult. You know what I mean? So like, there's ego and there's all these issues. And I'm saying to people, look, I know my platform is called Project Unity, but I'm not a saint. Don't expect me to always be a saint. And so I don't think it's about necessarily that kind of like, oh, he or she is some devout saint-like person. No, it's clarity of vision. It's intention. And because of, like I said, I had this weird synchronistic journey that led to the concept of contact clicking into place in a way that felt like an answer from the universe. You know, to very quickly tell you, I was basically sitting on my bed one night and just saying out loud to the universe, like, all of these things I've been learning about consciousness and quantum mechanics and what might happen after death, like, I'm fascinated by it, but how does this improve my life? Like, how does this change anything in my life? Give me something to do. Please give me something to work with that proves these concepts in some form of way that I can actually do myself. And then a week later, this is before I was even interested in UFOs, so that was not on my conscience. A week later, my best friend is like, hey, you need to watch this documentary, Unacknowledged, by Dr. Stephen Greer. First ever introduction to the UFO subject. Watch the documentary. Obviously, it introduces some of the military guys and, you know, the Minutemen missile officers and people that go, oh, okay, that seems pretty legit. That's interesting. So it started me down that curious thread with UFOs. But it's near the end of that documentary where he says about this idea of being able to, elicit some form of a contact scenario through getting into meditative states. And that right there was a light bulb for me because of the previous week and basically requesting something.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
I truly think that was the definitive right. reason why I was able to do it. Because I went out like basically like a zealot. I had no doubt. I had like absolutely no doubt that was a answer from the universe, and it worked and changed my life direction. So I think, you know, it's not about being some perfect exemplar of a human being who's operating at higher consciousness 24/7, but it's the ability to refine the signal, the noise and the signal in human consciousness and intention and belief. You know, as you would know from your studies, we are ritualistic creatures, and ritual kind of creating almost like a way to hack the algorithm in a sense by, right, well, we put this here and we sing from this particular text and then we do this and then we do that. We put these places in motion. It's not necessarily the objects or the incantations. It's your belief in them that actually seems to be the kind of the keystone. And so, I would say that it's intention with this type of contact methodology, which is why it's basically the worst thing in the world for skeptics. It's like, well, I don't believe in it. It's like, well, you're never going to see it then. Well, oh, that's convenient. That's very convenient that because I don't believe it, I'm not going to see it. And it's like,
yeah,
buddy, I don't know what to tell you. It kind of feels like that might be one of the prerequisites here. It's a difficult one to figure out for sure.
Yeah, I think so. Wow, that's really interesting. And I agree with you. When people look at the history of saints, when do you start to get into studying about this? I saw this when I was in graduate school, because I actually, my master's program was at the Jesuit School of Theology, taking classes at UC Berkeley, doing a kind of an academic degree with priests in formation, by the way. So these were Jesuit priests in formation. And what I saw was that we would do a deep dive into the primary sources for a lot of the saints. And the saints turned out to be not so holy, you know, in the sense right. that we think of them as being super holy, right? And, you know, this challenged their belief system so much. Some people actually dropped out of their seminary. And so I got to see that. But, I mean, it never actually impacted me and my faith because, you know, I knew there was something, but I just didn't. I just knew that I was supposed to learn about this. And so, you know, So I think this is a key idea that there, it's not about the, what our preconceived notions of, you know, does this person go to church every day or every week?
Right.
And, you know, is this, no, it, that's not what it's about. In fact, if we study communities of monastics and, you know, in all the religious traditions, we get some really interesting pictures. And if you study the people who are like the high functioning people in the space program, you get some pretty interesting pictures, very similar to the monastic practices. And they're, a lot of them have to do with lifestyle choices, you know, and, you know, I actually have talked a lot about this because people ask me about the protocols, you know, what are these protocols that Tyler did? Well, these are like the monastic protocols, and yeah, they'd actually work. And maybe some people have said, oh, you have to be OCD to follow those. Okay. You know, don't follow them. I'm not trying to make anybody follow them. I'm just interested in this type of, you know, connection that, that some people have with, like, the St. Francis connection, I guess you could call it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's different strokes for different folks. I mean, some people will listen to binaural isochronic tones and be like, oh my God, it reverberated my astral form right out of my body. Another person will say, it just sounds like my refrigerator running. You know,
right, like, right.
It doesn't
yeah.
mean anything to me. And they're just closed off to it. So there's going to be something for everyone, and not everything's going to be for everyone. So, you know, I always try and keep an open mind when it comes to, like, for example, you know, this whole idea of making contact. I'm like, look, I can't tell people how to do that kind of stuff. It worked a certain way for me. Perhaps it will work like that for you if you're of a similar mind. But if you're not, it's probably a different method to achieving this. But, you know, what struck me as just so profound is it is achievable. And it brings up a lot of questions about human consciousness, about non-locality of consciousness, and how the universe kind of does seem to respond to this concept of manifestation and animism, I suppose, that everything is in some way ambiently aware and responsive. Obviously, then you have the quantum side of it, where it looks like we literally collapse photons and electrons into position just by existing. You know, so yeah, everything's starting to feel like a simulation, spiritual or otherwise.
You know, this idea of animism is, a friend of mine reframed that for me and said, in my community, we call that molecular intelligence.
I like that.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of people are talking about, okay, so obviously, you know, trees have like literally like a infrastructure for, you know, a communication and things like that. But what about things like, you know, your couch or, you know, like you mentioned your refrigerator, things like that. And my friend said, oh no, those have their own way of being too. And it's called molecular intelligence. And so so that's like the scientist form of animism, I think.
Yeah, I like that. I could almost imagine, I mean, unless there is some weird alternate dimension inside the perception of a refrigerator where it's going to work and stuff like that, which I kind of doubt. I don't think it's the same kind of situation. I would almost imagine that that type of ambient consciousness is almost like, I'm just happy to be aware. I'm just an awareness that's happy to be aware. I'm serving the purpose of being a molecule inside of a scaffolding. And it's just kind of like a baseline ambient consciousness, just kind of knows that its job is to keep going because it's keeping the whole thing running, basically. I mean, that's just the interpretation, but I can't imagine it's kind of sitting there, each molecule going, gosh, this is a pretty boring existence, isn't it? Just being a part of a refrigerator or something like that.
Right. You know? Yeah.
Probably a different slice of awareness to a human being in that sense. But no, I do hold to that. And I think my experience is reinforced, at least to some level, a perception of faith that there is this type of intelligence that's weaving things together. As I think Albert Einstein said, that he can see the clock, but can't envision the clockmaker. It's too large, it's too complex. And we're in a very interesting time period right now where we're starting to maybe connect some of these foundational dots through science, through hopefully a resurgence of spirit, which is what gives me a lot of hope that psychedelic research is coming back into play. I don't know if you saw any of the panel talks from the extended state DMT trials that came out recently.
Amazing.
Yeah.
It's almost unbelievable. Yeah, it's very interesting.
Very novel stuff happening in the consciousness realm, novel stuff happening in the quantum physics realm, non-human intelligence being discussed. As I said before, and as we were talking about, does feel like we're in some sort of a chapter change. I don't want to keep you for too much longer. This has been a really, really great talk, though. I'm so glad that you took a little bit more time to kind of dig into some of this more philosophical territory. I like, this is my territory. I like exploring the thoughts and the ideas around this stuff, you know?
Yeah, I do too. And thank you so much for having me on.